has pretty much finished at the BBC. I was approached by Capital Radio, and I was asked if I would do the breakfast show. One of the consequences of the drugs offence was that I hadn't been allowed to visit America.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. David Simons.
Where I was in the world was Berkhamsted in Hertfordshire, and I attended Berkhamsted School. I was okay. I mean, I don't think I was a genius. I was okay. I hated it. I mean, I absolutely hated it. My mother was an interesting character. She was a very talented woman who taught French and did everything. I mean, she used to make things and keep chickens. And post-war society was very different, I guess, to anything that we know now. Real hand-to-mouth. I mean, we had a small house in Berkhamsted and grew vegetables and did sort of pretty much everything. There was still rationing in my youth. I was never really close to my father. I didn't really know too much about him. Well, I didn't know anything about him. Even less as a human being, probably, than I did about him professionally. I mean, he was Deputy Director General of MI5, therefore not allowed to speak about his home life. All I knew was that he was something to do with the civil service. I was expelled from school. It was an unfortunate event, I suppose, mostly for my parents. But in the end, I mean, great fortune ensued from it because, I mean, I was expelled basically for shagging. You know, it was all right to do it with boys behind the bike shed, but girls were completely taboo. But the good news was that after I eventually did get into Oxford, not, by the way, to New College, but at St. Catherine's, the school, you know, they used to publish their Oxford and Cambridge results. Oh, we got 6 into Oxford this year and 8 into Cambridge. They asked if they could include me in their numbers, and my father quite rightly said no.
Well, that's all, folks. Just about time to go. All of us here hope that you enjoyed the show. See you next Monday then at 1 o'clock with the Top of the Pops plus the latest drop. David Ead here saying cheerio, and come on, everybody, let's go, man, go with the Arabian Band.
I listened to everything. I mean, I used to actually fake illness at school because if I was ill, I was allowed to stay in bed all day and eat crisps and drink Heinz tomato soup and listen to the radio. So I did that quite a lot. And I listened to everything. I listened to the home service. I listened to the light program. And in the evening, of course, I listened to Radio Luxembourg. So, yes, I listened a lot. In those days, I mean, you know, all the comedy programs, of course, were de rigueur. Everybody had to listen to those. Sunday lunchtimes, not just me, but the whole family would tune into Two-Way Family Favorites and Hancock and The Goons. And there was that sort of slab of comedy which came on after lunch, I believe, after the Two-Way Family Favorites had finished. I remember all of them, and I used to write to a lot of them and ask them for signed photos, many of which later appeared.
This is the BBC Light Programme. Fraternising with Home Service natives is forbidden.
Oh, yes?
I told you we'd be at the...
I've seen you tiptoeing into the typist pool at the dark.
Well done.
That was only for a moonlight swim, sir.
A moonlight swim in your pyjamas? I don't believe my ear trumpets.
All lies, dear listeners. I wore not the pyjamas, I wore bathing drawers of the...
I wanted primarily to be an actor. And many years later, after I'd been discharged from Oxford, and you see, Oxford I liked, but Berkhamsted was a terrible, terrible preparation for Oxford because at Berkhamsted one was subjected to incredible discipline, I mean obscene discipline. And then when you got to Oxford, it was completely free. So in that respect, a public school was a completely inappropriate place to prepare a boy for Oxford, having gone through 6 or 7 years of absolute perjury, to then be sort of cut loose and given freedom, because at Oxford you could do anything you like if you wanted to go. Lectures weren't compulsory. You'd get your reckoning, you know, come examination if you didn't go. Which is what happened to me. So, I'm having been used to being caned and abused and gone through all of that ridiculous shit that happened at public school, I didn't do anything at Oxford. After I'd been sent down from Oxford, I did a number of things. I joined voluntary service overseas, and I spent some time in Austria where after the Hungarian Revolution there was a shortage of accommodation and the Austrians were sheltering Hungarian refugees. And I went over there as a bricklayer, not that I knew anything about that, and eventually got expelled from Austria because it was a dreadful place. I don't know if it still is, but it certainly was then. And I can remember working with a couple of guys, an American and an Austrian. We went back to the guest house that we were staying in. A typical sort of Germanic-looking guy, you know, wearing the breeches and the shorts, came over and sort of slapped some food down on the table and muttered something and went off. And it was ham and eggs. And Max's, the Austrians, was, you know, well-prepared. And mine and Randy's, the Americans, was like a mess. And so we said to Max, what did he say? And Max kind of shuffled about a bit and he didn't really want to answer. And eventually we teased it out of him. And he said, well, if you really don't want to know, he said, warm food for my Austrian friends and cold food for the English bastards. Whereupon Randy and I repaired to the kitchen and sorted him out. And the police were called and we were deported the following day. After that, my father was running out of options, really. I'd also got my girlfriend pregnant, which wasn't a great move at that particular time. So I think my parents by then just wanted to get rid of me. So my mother's younger brother, George, was in New Zealand at the time. So my father bought me a one-way ticket to New Zealand. And George, Uncle George, was deputed in loco parentis, because you have to remember that then the age of majority was 21 and I was only 18, and my parents, being very proper people, thought, well, we have to obey the law. We can't just cut this boy loose. So someone has to be appointed. So George was legally appointed my guardian in loco parentis, and I got on a boat at St. Catherine's Dock in London, accompanied by my father. I couldn't wait to see the back of him, to be honest. And I had £15, and we sailed for New Zealand. It took 5 weeks. I'd spent the 15 quid by the time we got to Wellington, and sold my transistor radio for the first week's rent. I began because I'd been studying botany at Oxford. I began with the New Zealand Forestry Service in the South Island, but it was very lonely. I mean, I was living in a camp halfway up a mountain, and I was very unfit. It took me quite a while to get fit, because New Zealand boys used to take the piss out of me. I eventually got fit enough to do the work. But it was a lonely, grim job. The guys were fantastic. I did enjoy their company. And eventually I left. And George was a nutcase anyway. I mean, he was enough to try anybody's patience, let alone a young man's. So I left and went on my own to Wellington, where I got a job in a bar. It was a cocktail bar, it was a posh bar at the Waterloo Hotel just opposite the station. And I worked upstairs in this bar. One day, Shirley Bassey came in. She was on tour and she was singing in Wellington. And she was staying at the Waterloo Hotel. And she came in and she ordered a cocktail. I don't remember what it was, but I served it. And she gave me £5 and said, keep the change.
I who have nothing.
I wanted, still wanted to be an actor.
I who have no one.
So I went and I took a drama audition, which I passed. But I was told that because drama was in its infancy then, that the people that they used were part-time. If they mounted sort of two television productions or three television productions a year, that clearly wasn't going to pay enough to live on. So the people that they used, the actors that they used, were, you know, had other jobs. And this was explained to me. And I said, well, do you have anything which pays on a full-time basis? And they said, well, yeah, you know, announcers. So I asked for an announcer's audition, and I took that and passed it. And that was the beginning. I was sent up to Napier to do a year's training. And I was very happy up there. And I then sent for my girlfriend, who'd come across from England, the same one, and the first baby, unfortunately, was sent for adoption because we were underage. And another piece of lunacy from the past. You had no say in your own affairs. It was ridiculous. anyway, Diana came across and we got married and had another baby. And at the end of that first year, I was transferred down to Wellington. I think that the regional stations were probably used as spawning grounds for new talent. And anybody that showed any promise was then later invited down to head office. And that's what happened to us. A great training ground, because we had two stations up in Napier. There was a 2YZ, which I suppose you'd compare with the Home Service, and 2ZC, which I guess you'd compare with not even the light programme, maybe Radio 1.
Good music you'll find, the weather and time, and everyday coverage of news.
You're having a better breakfast on the Neville Madden Breakfast Show from Action Radio 2ZC.
What a wonderful way to listen to radio.
And then when I went down to Wellington, there was an even broader range. I mean, from classical music through to talk and news and middle of the road and television, of course. And so we did all of that, television news and television weather. So I was right across the whole field, which put me in great stead for what was to come later.
Don't miss out. Meet all your stars in Stars of 65, Peter Poser. The fantastic voice of Tommy Adderley. Oh,
yeah. Everybody wanted to be in pop music, and that included me. Funnily enough, I was thinking about this the other day, and I even wrote it up in my diary. The NZBC planned to launch their own pop show called Teen Scene, which was really a sort of a copy of Top of the Pops, which the BBC had launched in January 1964. So in 1965, the NZBC planned Teen Scene, and a lot of guys and women applied for it. I mean, everybody wanted to be the face of youth for New Zealand, and I was one of them. I so wanted it. I mean, I wanted it so badly. Eventually, my audition turned out to be successful, and I got it. But then, in a fit of stupidity, I went out to celebrate and got pissed. And drove my car along the streets of Wellington, which at that time were crisscrossed with tram tracks. It was a rainy night and the car tires got stuck in tram tracks. And I had to jerk the steering wheel to sort of get away from them, and drove straight into a lamppost and put my bottom teeth through my lower lip. Was hospitalised, and the producer of Teen Scene, I can remember his name, a guy called Phil Wilbraham, came into hospital and he said, I can't use you looking like that. And the job went to the runner-up auditionee. And that was enough. The disappointment of that was enough to make me want to move. And so at the end of 65, we all embarked on the Australis and sailed back to England. I didn't have anything lined up at all. I had a couple of letters in my pocket, one to Alan Freeman and another one to Michael Miles, but that was all I had.
Now it's time to meet this evening's competitors as they come forward to do battle with me in the celebrated yes-no interlude. I'm sure you know the rules as well as I do, so let's meet our first contestant. A nice welcome.
I met Michael Miles. He was a nice guy. We had a pint of Guinness in a bar in the Aldwych opposite Associated Television. Nice guy, couldn't do anything for me. And then I went to see Alan Freeman do Pick of the Pops. At the BBC, I'd phoned Dennis Jones, and I was allowed to sit in and watch the great man. And, I mean, he did it with great skill, because in those days there was nothing in the way of equipment as there is now. But also the way in which it was done. I mean, you know, these days, or even in the analogue days, it was commonplace for people to self-operate. But in the BBC, no. So you had a guy with literally a microphone and a glass of water on a green baize table, one side of the glass, and that's all he had. And on the other side of the glass, you had the producer and the panel engineer and various tape operators, because the BBC had no cart machines, nothing like that. So all your kind of inserts and jingles and funny bits or whatever were all on 10-inch open-reel studios and were played in on cue. So this guy just sat there, and when he wanted the next thing to happen, he'd wave his finger through the glass and somebody would press a button. So the timing of it was incredible. I mean, how Freeman kept it that tight without having hands on anything was simply remarkable.
I've never seen so many new releases in all my life as came along this week, some of them coming up now, including a few of the Song for Europe records. But first of all...
Went back to his flat afterwards for a cup of tea and a chat. That was very interesting. I thought he was a very interesting man, and that had a profound impression on me. He was a wonderful man in every respect. He was deep, and I found out something about him which was, to me, very interesting, because having seen him do this incredible show at 100 miles an hour, then we went back to St. John's Wood, and he said, well, let me show you what I'm really interested in. And he played me a lot of grand opera, and he said, yeah, the pop music thing's okay and it's what I do for a living, but this is what I really like. And he had an encyclopedic knowledge of grand opera, and I was astonished. I did a round of auditions. I applied to everybody. I applied to the BBC. I applied to Radio Luxembourg. I applied to various regional television companies, Anglia in Norwich, Granada in Manchester. I sent off a round robin of applications. Oh, all the pirate ships, of course, as well. It's difficult to say, I mean, because it sounds immodest, but they all came up. You have to remember that I was a married guy with a young child, and I went for comfort. I mean, the comfort would have been the BBC. I was engaged at the age of 22 as a staff announcer. It meant that I had the privilege, I guess, of joining a common room of which extended to wartime announcers like Alvar Liddell and Philip Slesser, who were still there when I joined. I mean, guys who were, for me, part of broadcaster history. And I shared the same oak-panelled common room with these legends.
Here is the midnight news, and this is Alvar Liddell reading it. Up to 10 o'clock, 175 German aircraft had been destroyed in today's raids over this country. Today was the most costly for the German Air Force for nearly a month. In daylight raids, between 350 and 400 enemy aircraft were launched in two attacks against
London.
It was
a remarkable time for me. I mean, you know, one heard all the tales of newsreaders slipping coded messages to resistance workers into the bulletins, you know, and the resistance workers knew what they were listening for. I mean, it was a chapter that I wasn't involved with, but I just sort of got there in to lap up a little bit of the overspill, if you like.
How do you do, everybody? This is Philip Slesser speaking from the stage of the Golders Green Hippodrome, London, presenting the people of variety to a variety of people. Supporting our artists today, we have, as usual, Billy Turnant's orchestra with the maestro himself, Billy Turnant.
I did home and third, but not so much as the light programme, because I'd got a younger voice. Light programme actually was, you know, where it's all started to go forward, because I began on Breakfast Special. Breakfast Special was very heavily formatted. You were only allowed to back announce, time check twice, and then forward announce. So typically, it would go like this. It would go, that was the band of the Coldstream Guards with the Radetzky March. The time is 6:11. That is 11 minutes past 6. And now we're going to hear, etc. And that was the format. So I thought that was not very entertaining, and I started to improvise and send it up. And it began to take off, and that was the beginning of it all, I suppose. And I can remember being summoned by Dennis Morris, who was the controller of the light programme. And he had big teeth. He paced up and down on his office carpet. And he said, I'm not sure about this humour in the morning, David. He said, yes. He said, not until I've sort of been up for a while and been to the rear. He actually said that. Been to the rear, that I think I'm ready for any humour. But it went very well. Breakfast Special was the open sesame. Many years later, I got a letter from Ray Moore in which he recognised what I'd done. And he said, you know, if you hadn't done that, if you hadn't opened up those mornings, he said, there never would have been space for me and there never would have been space for Terry Wogan. And I took that as a huge compliment. Anyway, after Breakfast Special, I was approached by Ron Belchier. I was asked to go out to Heathrow to get an interview with the Beach Boys. which I did, I went back and with the interview, and Ron said, would you be interested in hosting Easy Beat? Well, as you know, I mean, Easy Beat and Saturday Club were the only pop music programmes on the BBC at that time, and Brian Matthew had held down Saturday Club for years, and Keith Fordyce, similarly on Sunday mornings with Easy Beat. So the opportunity to take over Easy Beat from Keith Fordyce was, I mean, a no-brainer. So that was the next stage.
10 seconds to go before Radio 1, Tony Blackburn, and Radio 2, Paul Hollingdale. Stand by for switching. Get tuned to Radio 1 or 2, 5, 4, 3. Radio 2, Radio 1, go.
The voice of Radio 1.
It began on a Saturday, didn't it? So I had to listen to the Saturday and the Sunday before I started on the Monday afternoon. What I heard was pretty good, I have to say. And I particularly enjoyed John Dunn's interjection in the Roscoe show on Saturday morning, when Roscoe had been off his nut and, you know, on these American slogans, sort of Wolfman Jack before Wolfman.
I can't take it no more, baby. Your man's going right out of his skull.
And John Dunn came in and said, "And now here is the news in English," which I thought was marvellous.
12:30 on Radio 1, the news in English.
Personally and collectively, I think. Personally because I did some stupid things, and collectively because I don't think it ever fulfilled its potential. And I think that's probably down to lack of good leadership. You see, the executive producer had say over everything, and the presenter had, well, as much input as the executive producer would allow him. And then there was a needle time restriction, you must remember. So that only 40%, I believe, of my programme came from gramophone record. The rest of it was item recorded on quarter-inch mono tape.
Radio 1, David Simon.
David Simon? Fantastic. What kettle on, mother?
The old ones are still the best, aren't they? I think I shall crawl back into my little hole and I shall forget forever the idea of doing anything new. Anyway, for all mothers who are listening to Radio 1 this evening, here's your record, and it comes from Barry Ryan.
Well, I was doing a Radio 1 club, and it was traditional to go up the night before, stay in a hotel, and then check into the top-ranked suite the following morning. And I did that, and forgot my bag. I left my bag in the hotel. And a conscientious manager, being unwilling to open the bag without a witness being present, called a cop off the street, and the contents of the bag were tipped out onto the reception desk, and a small amount of the green stuff was there. I'd gone down to the top rank suite, and the kids had been let in, and I was warming them up and trying to hype them into a state of mild hysteria when a hand descended upon my shoulder and a guy said, "You're under arrest." And it was like 11:40. And I said, "Well, can I do this first?" And he said, "Yeah, okay." Keith Skews, who was down in London, handed over. And I had to do this Radio 1 club with these two guys standing in the wings. Afterwards, I was taken down to the police station and read my rights and fingerprinted and slung in a cell. And I knew that they would raid my home as well, and I wasn't allowed to phone. So, yeah, in due course, a team busted my home in Surrey. My wife, of course, being completely unprepared for that. And it was all horrible. I then had to tell my father. I had to tell the BBC. My father was predictably horrified. The BBC pretended not to be horrified. The controller of Radio 1 at that time was Douglas Muggeridge. Robin Scott had moved on, sadly, because he was a real luminary. And Douglas Muggeridge did this kind of boys will be boys thing. It's all right, old boy, you know, quite understand. Why won't in any way affect your prospects or your career? He did all that stuff, and I've foolishly believed him. And of course it did. It did impact on my career. And I think by the time we got to sort of 70 or 71, I was pretty much finished at the BBC. I don't think I felt too much directly about it. I mean, the consequences of it I felt, because, you know, I'd moved to a nice house in East Molesey, and you know how it is on Schedule D. When you're self-employed, you pay tax like 18 months after the event. So in the early 70s, I was paying tax for the good years of like 68, 69. And I just couldn't raise the money. I mean, the only way that I could pay my tax bill was to sell my house. So I had to do that. And we went and stayed with my parents for a while. I developed an interest in production. Unlike, I think, most of my colleagues, I remember once, I'm digressing, I remember once Nicky Horn saying to me at Capital, he said, the difference between you and the rest of us is that we sit here and we only care about, you know, what we're saying into this side of the microphone, whereas you follow it through the desk and the wires and all the way to the transmitter, and you care about all that stuff. He said, I couldn't give a shit. So I started to get into all of that, and I went to just about every single album, I think, that the Moody Blues ever recorded, and I became friends with other producers, other than Tony Clark, that is. And eventually, I think in 1973, I wound up as production manager at Radio Luxembourg, feeding DJs scraps, producing commercials. I was quite busy there, and I enjoyed it. We used to get out to the Grand Duchy every now and again and meet up with the guys. I particularly liked Dave Christian. And, yeah, it was a good time.
This is the Soul Sensation. Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome along to the program. Many thanks, Bob Stewart, for the last 1.5 hours. We're going to get into a little Miracles goal right now. Go into a go-go.
Well, at the end of 1973, I was approached by Aidan Day, who'd been appointed music director at Capital Radio. And I was asked if I would open it up and do the breakfast show for them. So I went to Alan Keane, who's head of Radio Luxembourg, and gave him my resignation. I don't think I was driven by getting back on air, but it was so exciting, you know, that London... I mean, because I bought completely into the ILR argument. No, and no reservations about it at all. And it was a great team, you know, headed up by Richard Attenborough, who was inspirational. I was a bit less enamoured of Michael Bucht, the programme director. But there were some very talented people there, undoubtedly.
Good morning. This, for the very first time, is Capital Radio.
A wonderful pioneering atmosphere, the sort of half-finished Euston Tower building. I mean, unprepared to the extent that at 4 o'clock, I think we went on air at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, they were still wiring up the studio. I'd fallen asleep in the boys' room with my head against the porcelain, and people went out looking for me. And I went into the studio, and Chaz Kennedy was still under the desk with a soldering iron. I said, Christ, will you be finished by 5 o'clock? And he said, I hope so. It was great.
Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Waters. Good morning from myself, David Simons. The time is 5:09 on the first day of Capital Radio. It is not going to be a customary habit to deliver long diatribes on Capital Radio. It is your station. May I just sincerely say, on behalf of those people that you won't be meeting, the people who made this whole exercise possible, Richard Attenborough, Brian Forbes, Michael Bucht, the program controller, our general manager, Tony Salisbury. These are the nicest people with whom I have ever been associated in my entire career.
I was very emotional, I remember that. And I spoke very slowly, and I sound kind of drunk when I listen back to the recordings. I don't think I was, might have been. And then in reading out the tributes, I forgot John Whitney's name, and I kind of never lived that down. People kept reminding me. I think Whitney kept reminding me.
I should have mentioned our managing director, Mr. John Whitney, who's been such a source of inspiration to us all.
It was fun. I mean, my show just didn't work at all. Well, one of Michael Bucht's weaknesses, and it was a weakness,
He didn't have much of a radio background. I think he'd done a little bit in radio, JBC, Radio Jamaica. But before Capital, he'd been a producer with Nationwide, which was an early evening current affairs program on BBC television. And he was a guy who believed that he could create double acts. He didn't get the concept that you can't create a double act, that double acts are born and not made. So he threw together Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton.
We have a news bulletin, and then Tommy Vance and Joan Shenton entertained through the morning until 11 o'clock, when Peggy Mount stars in a day-to-day serial called Bedsit. It's a down-to-earth, humorous, and we think very amusing and entertaining serial. And then after that, Tommy and Joan carry on until midday, and at midday...
And he threw me together with Monty Modlin. I mean, mercifully, for my sake, I liked Monty. I mean, he and I got on very, very well. But, I mean, I never met the man before in my life. And he was the outside broadcast bit. And why the show failed was because the equipment kept failing. So, you know, I was in the studio saying, right, you know, now over to Monty Modlin, who would be with a surprise package on someone's doorstep in Clapham. And the link wouldn't work. And so there'd be a few seconds of silence and crackling and then another record. I mean, it was awful.
The title from String Driven Thing, It's a Game. What a sensational single that one is, and just watch it move too. 24 minutes past 8. Monty Modlin, it's a cold day, but how are you getting on?
Here I am, David, with a crowd of people about 60 or 70, including lots of school children. Now, children, did you know that there's a terrible shortage of policemen in London and that they need a lot more wages, they say? Do you think we ought to have more policemen?
Yes.
How old are you, darling?
11.
Just on your way to school?
Yes.
What do you think about the police? Do you think that they deserve more money, dear?
Yes, because they do a good job.
They do?
Yes.
Do you think it's a dangerous job?
Yes.
Yeah, there are lots of people... There's an older lady here, grey hair, looking very smiling, very nice. Aren't you, love? Yes.
They'd gone over, I think Aidan and Bucket had gone over to America, and they'd come back with this rather elaborate, yes, I do recall it now, they'd come back with this rather elaborate system of colour-coded music, so that in order to give DJs input into the programming, there were these jars on desks with these coloured spills in them, you know, like tapers. So there'd be an orange one and a green one and a blue one, and these were supposed to represent different tempos. So to build a good show, a DJ would pick out one of these spills with a title and an artist written on it and place it on a sort of plastic folder thing. And then, you know, eventually you'd build a page and take that page to a photocopier and then put the spills into another jar, so that which was the do not use jar, so that the following DJ could also go to the jar with the spills in, but he couldn't go to the do not use jar, because otherwise you'd get titles and artists being replicated before, you know, the correct rotation had been reached. I remember after a few months, the spills kind of turned into matchwood, because they'd been used so much. So these sort of little shards of splintered wood all over the table. I can't remember how long that lasted. Not very long, I suspect.
There we go, that's Fox, and only you. Time now is 24 minutes to 11 o'clock.
Capital Climber.
From Slade, called...
How does it feel?
Well, like most things I've done, it went progressively downhill. I started with The Breakfast Show, then I went to mornings. For some reason, Buck thought that, Tommy and Joan didn't work. For whatever reason, it didn't work. Dave and Joan will work. So I went in as a double act with Joan Shenton for a bit. Lovely lady, but not a great team behind the microphone, I have to say. And it kind of went down and down and down until eventually I was offered the overnight shift, which I politely declined. Well, probably not very politely.
Radio Victory on 257 metres in the medium wave band and 95 megahertz in VHF stereo begins transmission on Tuesday, October the 14th, 1975, at 1 p.m.
I've always got on pretty well with most of my peers. I mean, the ground troops. I've always got on well with them, not so much the officers. So when I was given the opportunity to do that, I'd always kind of had a hankering to do that. Well, I wouldn't have applied for the job if I hadn't thought I could do it. and we launched from a derelict church institute in Fratton. I was living in Cobham, and so I was commuting. I was driving down there each day. And I was able, because I had lots of friends, I was able to talk to them and say, well, look, you know, why don't you get out of London and come down here where the air is cleaner and there's more sunshine and there's the New Forest and the South Downs and get a different life. And a lot of them said, yeah. And I was able to fill the slots quite easily. In fact, I only had two places left over for locals. I mean, there obviously had to be local job opportunities, and I kept two of them open. I hired on the advice of Eugene Fraser, who had come down as deputy head of programs, Jack McLaughlin, whom I hadn't known at all. But, you know, if Eugene said he was a good bet, that was good enough for me. And Jack came down and, you know, during the dry runs, he excelled. And so I put him into breakfast. And I remember then Blair Scott in Southampton, who was the local IBA officer, said, why would you put a Scotsman into the breakfast show in Portsmouth? And in particular, why would you put in Hoochter Chuchter McLaughlin? I said, well, Blair, if you go down to the dockyard there and open the hatch of any ship and shout down, oi, Jock, watch how many of them come up. And so we launched with a very seasoned and highly experienced team. And we did gangbusters. I mean, we got 74% of the Portsmouth audience in our first survey. Like most of the other things, it started off very well. It was an illusion. It was an illusion because we deliberately created it. We deliberately created the illusion of it being California. It was sun, sea, and surf. And that was the image that I wanted to project, even though it was a false image. It projected well.
Right, a shop around there from Captain Antoniel. Don't you dare follow that advice. If you found us on 257 or 95 megahertz in the medium wave band, you stay where you are. Shopping is verboten. 24 minutes to one is the time, and yesterday Eugene Fraser was out and about with his portable tape recorder sampling some opinions of...
Well, I had a row with authority. I mean, what else would you think? I suppose before we leave that, having thrown the dolls out of the pram, you know, I got fired. And then I sued them. And they settled out of court. I ran an 8-track studio out of my home for a while. And then I went back to the BBC. Eugene Fraser had by then also fallen on his sword and gone back to the Beeb. And he said, well, you know, why don't you do the same? Because Radio 4 is quite a nice place now. They've got a guy called Jim Black running it. Jim was a scouser. He wasn't sort of typical BBC management at all. So I contacted Jim, and he was very pleased. And he said, yeah, bloody right. You know, if you want to come back, come back. So I went back to Radio 4. Continuity in news.
It's Thursday, November the 23rd. This is BBC Radio 4, serving the whole of the United Kingdom on 1,500 metres, 200 kilohertz, and on VHF FM in England. Welcome. We're glad you found us. And welcome to our new listeners in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland. And welcome to our new friends who may be listening across the English Channel. Welcome, gentlemen sailing the high seas. We hope you'll stay with us in the days to come and tell your friends about the new national service of the BBC. We go now to the BBC Radio Newsroom in London and join Peter Donaldson for the late news.
Well, it was okay. I mean, but Jim didn't last long. David Hatch was appointed managing director of radio, and he took Jim along as his sidekick. So Jim was sort of booted upstairs, and he was replaced by a woman called Helen Wilson. And I just didn't like her at all. I'd known her for some while, and eventually she was my reason for getting out of there. And I went across to Radio 2, where Cyril Drake, the guy who many years previously had been the executive producer on Breakfast Special, they'd been listening to beautiful music programs from America. I mean, beautiful music, probably dead now, but beautiful music was quite a big deal in America at that time. So they'd decided on a beautiful music strip on Radio 2 afternoons. And Cyril said, well, would you like to come across and do that? Well, it was a bit ridiculous, really, thinking about it. Or the BBC's version of it was a bit ridiculous. It started well. I began with a guy called Dennis O'Keefe. And one of the things about the BBC is that then they began to sort of rotate producers. So you never really sort of got into bed with anybody. You got to know them a little bit, and then they replaced him or her with someone else. But their idea of beautiful music wasn't what the Americans were playing. I mean, you know, the Americans were playing sort of almost item-written stuff, whereas the BBC was sort of playing Johnny Mathis and Percy Faith. And in fact, the theme tune was Percy Faith, theme from A Summer Place. It was okay. I mean, I don't take exceptional pride in it. It wasn't something that I think of as one of the high watermarks of my career.
You could treat me well by giving me the pleasure of your company at 4:15 tomorrow afternoon for another set of tunes, which we loosely call Much More Music. Although we try and play them tight. And if you have any favourite artists, any favourite tracks, please drop me a line at the BBC. It's Dave Simons, and it's the BBC London W1A 1AA. Remembering, of course, that the only criterion is quality.
Yeah, it was okay. Until the end. One Friday, I was called into David Hatch's office. I had no reason why he would want to talk to me. And he said, well, thank you very much, and that's it. You know, this afternoon's will be your last one, and thank you. I went, what? What's the reason? And he said, well, I don't have to give you a reason. That's, you know, I'm just saying thank you very much, and that'll do. I remember raising myself to my full height, and he's a very small man, was, and standing over his desk and saying, you are the most disgusting little man I've ever met in my life, and flouncing out. Then I went down to the studios. We had separate studios, sort of back-to-back, like bookends. And David Hamilton was on air in one of them. And I went in and told him. I said, Jesus, I've just been fired. And he said, why? I said, I don't know. I really don't know. And he said, what are you going to do about it? And I said, I'm going to take my clothes off and get pissed. So I took my clothes off and ordered some red wine. I think David told Baz Bamick Boy of the Daily Mail. It got into the press anyway.
BBC Radio 2.
I didn't give a fig. I mean, I don't know whether it was wise or not. I mean, it ended. I don't think it was unwise, because it ended a period of uncertainty, you know, of going to and from and flirting with the BBC and going in and out, Radio 4, Radio 1, Radio 3, Radio 2. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And I made up my mind there and then that I wasn't going to do it anymore. Now, one of the consequences of the drugs offence was that I hadn't been allowed to visit America, because for that you get a 10-year ban on entering the United States. And that was always a source of great regret to me, because I was unable to witness at first hand the development of American rock and roll. I didn't eventually get over there till, I think, 1980. But that was the moment, coming out of Much More Music, that I was determined to get over to the States and give it a shot. So I flew to Los Angeles and eventually got offered a job on KEZY, and spent a few years in California doing something that only circumstances in the BBC had prevented me from doing years earlier. Most of the properties in Los Angeles were owned by corporate entities, and mine was one of the very few radio stations which was privately owned. And the old guy that owned it died, and his family decided to sell it, not unreasonably. So we were all let go. I mean, it wasn't just me this time, it was everybody. So I had to look for work. You have to remember, at that time, which would have been 1984, it was the first year of Ronald Reagan's second term, and America was very gung-ho, and Uncle Sam and apple pie and all of that. So an Oxford English voice wasn't really in very high demand, and I hated being on the dole in California. It was awful. And I gave myself 3 months to try and find another job, knowing that, of course, I could always go back to the BBC. However many sins I'd committed, that they would always take me back. So after 3 months, I was still unable to find anything, and I went back to the Beeb. I went back to Radio 4.
The Peacock Committee, set up by the government 14 months ago to examine alternative methods of financing the BBC, has decided that advertising is not the answer. But in its 219-page report published this morning, it recommends that the BBC should have the option of selling off Radio 1 and Radio 2, which could then be supported by advertisements. The committee says that in the immediate future, the licence fee should be index-linked to the general rate of inflation. New television sets should
What attracted me to Capital Gold was that it wasn't Radio 4. I started off doing weekends, weekend breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings. And then when Kenny got sick, I was offered his place and went to weekday mornings, which I held on to until, I think, 94, somewhere around there. I was there for 7 years, so from 88, must have been 95. There was a night of the Long Knives, which I absolutely knew was coming. I mean, Richard Park, whom a lot of people disparage, is a guy for whom I have a lot of time. He did something quite remarkable when you think about it. I mean, you know, you've got an AM wavelength and a music format, and he got, on his first book, 24%. I mean, FM stations would kill for that now. A remarkable result, and he got it by recruiting a team of seasoned pros, paying them a lot of money to get him off the ground to a point where the thing had developed a momentum of its own, and he could cut costs by letting these guys go and bringing in cheaper DJs, which is exactly what he did. When I was let go, I was called in. I knew what the call was, and he told me. And I said, that's absolutely fine, Richard. You know, I've had 7 great years here. And he looked a bit surprised. And I said, look, you know, if I were an actor and I was hired for a West End show and I got a run of 7 years, I'd be over the bloody moon. And he said, well, I'm glad you said it like that. I said, well, I do. I did, and I still do.
7 minutes past 8 o'clock on London's all-time great music station. You're in tune with Capital Gold. At number 32, a huge climber from Connie Francis.
P-A-C-A-C-A-O-N. I mean, he was a tight formatter, Richard. So I can remember Monday mornings, after I'd taken over from Kenny, he came up with this thing of Motown Monday. So every Monday morning, I'd play the same bloody Motown records. I mean, how many are there? You know, great Motown recordings. Not that many. So this, you're turning over the same bloody 50 or 60 songs week in, week out. It was terrible. Well, at that time, I mean, after a series of sort of terminal disagreements with my then-girlfriend, I was living in Primrose Hill as a bachelor, and I'd bought a holiday apartment in Cyprus, and I'd found that I was able to kind of do a few gigs in London and then go and take a couple of weeks off in Cyprus. And eventually it kind of got more and more inverted. So actually I was living in Cyprus and then going back to London when there was a, you know, a good opportunity. And then I met a girl over in Cyprus who I eventually married. It kind of evolved into being in Cyprus from London. And then I got bored and did the only thing that I know what to do, which is radio, and opened a radio station there. It went very well until 2008. You know, we had the world financial crash. I wasn't national. I was a local station for Limassol, and a small local radio station is totally dependent on high street advertising. And it just stopped. And we went broke. So eventually found some Russian buyers for it and bailed out and came to France, which is where I am now. Living where I live, I wish I'd done this years ago. I really do. I mean, it's expensive. But, well, you know, I don't know why I didn't come to live in the south of France years ago. It is so bloody civilized, and the people are so nice. I know that the English traditionally dislike the French, but that's only because the English are nuts. And it's just such a great place to live. I want to live to be 100 because I had the good sense to marry a girl who is miles younger than I am, and I want to be here for her. I don't think very much of British broadcasting. I mean, with the exception of people like Johnny Walker and Ken Bruce, I think that the personality, and there are heavy quotation marks around that word, the personality obsession of the BBC is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, some of the people that they have on Radio 2 in particular are absolutely atrocious. And I do believe that, you know, whatever the topic is, whether it's astrophysics or popular music, you've got to know what you're talking about. Well, I mean, because I can't leave it alone, I mean, I still run a small radio station, as you know. Keeps me out of trouble. And I've also started, funnily enough, on the 1st of March, a diary, which I would have, or should have done, years and years ago, because my memory is beginning to fail. I've begun diarising my life. But it's not in the form of an autobiography. I don't ever want to get into that name-dropping and self-congratulation stuff. It's terrible. It's a stream of consciousness more than anything else. It's just a comment, and it's laced, as it has to be, with current affairs. I mean, you know, that you can't live through this World War III, which is what it is, without feeding that into it. I don't, as a sort of matter of human nature, tend to play the what-if game at all. But what if I'd swallowed my pride? Well, what if I'd accepted compromise? No. Not in this game. You'd never accept compromise. How would I like to be remembered? I don't think I'm that bothered by what they say.
David Simons. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and if you do enjoy reminiscing about radio, then do grab my book as well. It's called Radio Moments, looking back through my own eyes from both outside and inside the industry at the last fascinating 50 years.